15 years ago, Willie Parker had what sounds like an enviable life. He was an OBGYN, a faculty member at the University of Hawaii. He loved living in Honolulu. Willie was also a devout Christian, and if one of his patients wanted an abortion, he would refer them to another doctor. It wasn't that Willie opposed abortion, but he hadn't been trained in it, and throughout his career, he had worked in places where abortion wasn't really available anyway.
So it was more a lack of deep thought about whether or not there was actually a personal conflict between being Christian and providing abortions. And so I was able to operate in that milieu for the first 12 years of my practice.
Then the clinic in Hawaii where Dr. Parker worked got a new director who decided that clinic would stop offering abortion services altogether.
What was different this time and what brought me to what I call my come to Jesus moment and my moral crisis was that this time services were available. Hawaii was one of the first states to legalize abortion. And so in this particular clinic where indigent women were getting their care since 1970 up until 2001, over 30 years, they had had access to abortion care. And now this administrator was cutting it off. So now I was a part of a system that was going to deny women access. And so now it was personal for me. And so I had to decide, what was my reservation if I, to your point, didn't think abortion was morally wrong for a woman to make that decision? What was my inhibition around providing it?
You called it your inhibition. What was your inhibition?
Well, in the final analysis with the Good Samaritan story that Dr. King tells in his last sermon, there are two people who pass by an injured traveler. One's a priest and one's a Levite. One by vocation was obligated and one by community was obligated, and they both failed to help. And Dr. King speculated that their inability to help was potentially related to their concern about what would happen to them. And he said the Good Samaritan was good because he reversed the question of concern. And instead of asking, what will happen to me if I stop to help this person, he asked, what will happen to this person if I don't stop to help? And so what I came to conclude was that my inability to provide abortion wasn't that I thought it was immoral. It was my concern about how I would be perceived as a Christian, because I hadn't thought about whether or not it was truly mutually exclusive to be Christian and to provide abortion care. And I kind of came to the conclusion that it was a form of cowardice to not think about that more deeply and to conscientiously choose to provide or not to provide. And when I looked more deeply, I decided that compassion, which is an essential tenet of Christianity, does not modulate itself based on why the person has the need. It either responds to the need or it doesn't. And so it led me to conclude that I was not acting in accordance with my Christian values by refusing to provide the care that women need as a women's health provider.
You've said you grew up in the Southern Baptist Black Church and weren't sure whether Christianity and abortion were compatible. So I wonder, how do you maintain relationships with people who you love, whose Christian faith takes them to the opposite side of this abortion divide?
By rooting my Christian understanding in where I come from, and temporally, I came of age in the early 70s and 80s. By the time I was a teenager when I had my Christian conversion experience in 1978, this all predated the whole moral majority's rise to power and the whole pro-life, pro-choice narrative. So by rooting my religious experience in that time period, it becomes clear that my whole thinking about abortion was never colored by the whole pro-life, pro-choice narrative, which my religious conversion and coming of age predates. And so as I went along, by the time that was in full effect and full swing in the mid-80s, I was a medical student. And so it was starting to, and then the violence and stuff was starting to swell and the clinic bombings and all of that. And so in my community, the people that I came of age with religiously, that narrative was never a point of tension with us. And so now in my 50s, when I return home, people who knew me in my earlier Christian identity now recognize me as someone who's grown and evolved. And for those people who still approach the Bible as sacred text with a literal approach, it becomes clear to them that I don't approach the Bible or a Christian and spiritual understanding that way anymore. So we have honest disagreement. I came to realize that some of the people who I thought would be opposed to abortion, actually, they were supportive of abortion, and it didn't have anything to do with me because I wasn't aware that they were already supportive of women because we had never had the conversation. So there really hasn't been a major loss of personal relationships for me. I left Birmingham when I was 18 years old. I'm now 54. And so the people who now know me, because I'm very public about the work that I do, they understand and they respect, or there have been some relationships that have naturally demised, and that's all okay.
All of it's okay.
All of that's okay.
I ask you because you talk about honest disagreement. It just seems so hard around abortion. It seems like the kind of thing that tears us apart or keeps us apart. And I wondered if you had any advice about understanding one another across, maybe the divide is not huge to you, but it is to so many of us.
Oh, the chasm is deep and wide, and that's not lost on me. But part of an effort to bridge that chasm was related to why I wrote the book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. And that is, I decided that part of the tension is that the Mahatma Gandhi said that honest disagreement is the beginning of progress. And so if we're going to honestly disagree about the contentious issue of abortion, we have to be clear about how we're framing that conversation. And part of the tension is a false tension, I believe, related to scientific understandings of reproduction and religious or non-scientific understandings. And people unnecessarily pit those understandings against each other. Dr. King said that science gives mankind knowledge, which is power. Religion gives mankind wisdom, which is control. The two are not enemies. And I took that to mean, besides it being the wisdom by which I operate my life, as someone who's trained in obstetrics and gynecology, who my chosen craft is human reproduction, and as someone who's also a Christian, I'm trained as a scientist and I practice as a Christian, I'm clear that there's a religious understanding of reproduction and a scientific one, and they don't compete with each other. It only becomes problematic when we try and answer religious questions with scientific answers or scientific questions with religious answers. And so I, in effort to have a conversation that's focused on the morality of abortion, which encompasses we all are moral agents, we all make decisions, we all have a sense of what is right and wrong, but morals govern your personal behavior. The question is, should we be legislating something that is governed by conscience? My answer is no. And so if conscience is the domain of the religious and that's personal, then that means that the religious governance of reproduction should be with a person's conscience. But how we govern the practice of reproduction societally based on policies and rules and laws, that's not the same conversation. Science should govern those conversations.
Obviously, not everyone listening right now agrees with you, but Seattle is a very pro-choice town, and it sounds like maybe you would like them to think differently about this abortion chasm, as you said. It's deep and wide, but it's not unbridgeable?
It's not unbridgeable. I find the whole pro-life, pro-choice narrative problematic. It's categorical. It lends itself great to theater, but it doesn't lead to critical thinking. You know, pro-choice, pro-life means people can just kind of declare where they stand without thinking. The narrative is not pro-life, pro-choice. I'm pro-choice and pro-life. I'm in support of the life of the woman. I'm in support of a woman making choices about her life. Pro-life is not the same as being anti-abortion. So I think the real tension is that we don't have the right framing of the issue. The issue is anti-abortion and pro-abortion. And when I say pro-abortion, I'm pro-abortion in the same way a cardiothoracic surgeon is pro-heart transplant. They don't want people to have heart disease and to need a heart transplant, but they want to make sure that anybody who needs a heart transplant from cardiac disease can get one. So abortion is not bad, it's not good, it's necessary, and it is healthcare. Pro-life or anti-abortion is you don't want to have an abortion and you're free not to have one, but anti-abortion means you don't want anybody else to have an abortion. So that's a different from a pro-life, pro-choice. Pro-choice means the person who can have an abortion needs to be able to have one, but it's not the empowerment to force people to have abortions. So what should be the default? It has to be that people who want to have abortions and need to have them should be able to have them. People who don't want to have them aren't should be free not to have them, but no one should be able to encroach upon the other person if they don't agree.
I've been talking with Dr. Willie Parker, and the book is Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Welcome to Seattle, and thanks for talking with us, Doctor.
Thanks for having me.